desperately. "Light song," Blushweaver said. "If something that secret were going on, then why would the priests use those tunnels to come into the court? Wouldn't that be a little suspicious? I mean, if you noticed it, how hard could it be to discover?" Lightsong paused, then flushed slightly. "Of course," he said. "I got so wrapped up in pretending to be useful that I forgot myself. Thank you so much for reminding me that I am an idiot."
"Lightsong, I didn't mean..."
"No, it's quite all right," he said, standing. "Why bother? I need to remember who I am. Lightsong, self-hating god, the most useless person ever granted immortality. Just answer one question for me."
Blushweaver paused. "What question?"
"Why?" he asked, looking at her. "Why do I hate being a god? Why do I act so frivolous? Why do I undermine my own authority? Why?"
"I always assumed it was because you were amused by the contrast."
"No," he said. "Blushweaver, I was like this from the first day. When I awoke, I refused to believe I was a god, refused to accept my place in this pantheon and this court. I've acted accordingly ever since. And, if I might say, I've gotten quite a bit more clever about it as the years have passed, which is beside the point. The thing I must focus on, the important point here, is why."
"I don't know," she confessed.
"I don't either," he said. "But whoever I was before, he's trying to get out. He keeps whispering for me to dig at this mystery, keeps warning me that I'm no god, keeps prompting me to deal with all this in a frivolous way." He shook his head. "I don't know who I was. Nobody will tell me. But I'm beginning to have suspicions. I was a person who couldn't simply sit and let something unexplained slide away into the fog of memory. I was a man who hated secrets. And I'm only just beginning to understand how many secrets there are in this court."
Blushweaver looked taken aback.
"Now," he said, walking away from the pavilion, his servants hurrying to catch up, "if you will excuse me, I have some business to attend to."
"What business?"
Blushweaver demanded, rising. He glanced back. "To see Allmother. There are some lifeless commands that need to be dealt with."
Chapter 39. A week living in the gutters served to drastically change Vivenna's perspective on life. She sold her hair on the second day for a depressingly small amount of money. The food that she'd bought hadn't even filled her stomach, and she didn't have the strength to regrow the locks. The haircut didn't even have the dignity of being cleanly shorn. It was a ragged job of hackwork, and the remaining hair would have still been a pale white, save for the fact that it was matted and blackened with dirt and soot. She'd thought about selling her breath, but wouldn't even know where to go or how to go about it. Besides, she had a strong feeling that Denth would be watching places where she might sell the breath. Beyond that, she had no idea how to get the breaths back from her shawl, now that she'd put them into it. No, she had to remain secret, unseen, couldn't draw attention to herself. She sat on the side of the street, holding out her hand to the passing crowds, keeping her eyes down. No offerings came. She wasn't certain how the other beggars did it. Their meager earnings seemed an amazing treasure. They knew so much she didn't. Where to sit, how to plead. Passers learned to avoid beggars, even with their eyes. The successful beggars, then, were those who managed to draw attention. Vivenna wasn't certain if she wanted the attention or not. Though the gnawing pain of hunger had eventually driven her out onto busy streets, she was still frightened that Denth or Vasher might find her. The more hungry she got, the less other worries bothered her. Eating was a problem for now. Being killed by Denth or Vasher was a problem for later. The flood of people in their colors continued to pass. Vivenna watched them without focusing on faces or bodies, just colors. Like a spinning wheel, each spoke a different hue.
Denth won't find me here, she thought. He won't see the princess in the beggar on the side of the street.
Her stomach growled. She was learning to ignore it, just as the people ignored her. She didn't feel like she was a true beggar or child of the street, not after just 1 week. But she was learning to imitate them, and her mind felt so fuzzy lately, ever since she'd gotten rid of her breath. She pulled the shawl close. She kept it with her, always. She still hardly believed what Denth and the others had done. She had such fond memories of their joking. She couldn't connect that to what she'd seen in the cellar. In fact, sometimes she found herself rising to seek them out. Surely the things she'd seen had been hallucinations. Surely they couldn't be such terrible men.
That's foolish, she thought. I need to focus. Why isn't my mind working right anymore?
Focus on what? There wasn't much to think about. She couldn't go to Denth. Parlin was dead. The city authorities would be no help. She had now heard the rumors of the Idrian princess who had been causing such troubles. She'd be arrested in a heartbeat. If there were any more of her father's agents in the city, she had no idea how to locate them without exposing herself to Denth. Besides, it was a good chance that Denth had found those agents and killed them. He'd been so clever at keeping her captive, quietly eliminating those who could have taken her to safety. What did her father think? Vivenna lost to him. Every man he sent to retrieve her vanishing mysteriously. Halandrin inching closer and closer to declaring war. Those were distant worries. Her stomach growled. There were soup kitchens in the city. But at the first one she'd gone to, she'd spotted Tonk Fa, lounging in a doorway across the street. She turned and scurried away, hoping he hadn't seen her. For the same reason she didn't dare leave the city. Denth was sure to have agents watching the gates. Besides, where would she go? She didn't have the supplies for a trip back to Idris. Perhaps she could leave if she managed to save up enough money. That was hard. Almost impossible. Every time she got a coin, she spent it on food. She couldn't help herself. Nothing else seemed to matter. She'd already lost weight. Her stomach growled again. So she sat, sweaty and filthy, in the meager shade. She still wore only her shift and the shawl, though she was dirty enough that it was difficult to tell where clothing ended and skin began. Her former arrogant refusal to wear anything but the elegant dresses now seemed ridiculous. She shook her head, trying to clear the fog from it. 1 week on the street felt like an eternity. Yet she knew that she'd only just begun to experience the life of the poor. How did they survive? Sleeping in alleyways, getting rained on every day, jumping at every sound, feeling so hungry they were tempted to pick at and eat the rotting garbage they found in gutters. She'd tried that. She'd even managed to keep some down. It was the only thing she'd had to eat in 2 days. Someone stopped beside her. She looked up, eager, hands stretching out further until she saw the colors he wore. Yellow and blue. City Guard. She grabbed at her shawl, pulling it closer. It was foolish, she knew. Nobody knew about the breaths it contained. The move was reflexive. The shawl was the only thing she owned, and, meager though it was, several urchins had already tried to steal it from her while she slept. The guard didn't reach for her shawl. He just nudged her with his truncheon.
Hey, he said, move. No begging on this corner.
He didn't explain. They never did. There were apparently rules about where beggars could sit and where they couldn't, but nobody bothered to provide the specifics to the beggars. Laws were things of lords and gods, not the lowly.
I'm already starting to think about lords as if they were some other species.
Vivenna rose and felt a moment of nausea and dizziness. She rested against the side of the building, and the guard nudged her again, prompting her to shuffle away. She bowed her head and moved along with the crowd, though most of them kept their distance from her. Ironic that they would leave her space now that she didn't care. She didn't want to think about how she smelled, though more than the scent, it was the fear of being robbed that probably kept the others away. They needn't have worried. She wasn't skilled enough to cut purses or pick pockets, and she couldn't afford to get caught trying. She'd stopped worrying about the morality of stealing days ago. Even before leaving the slum alleys for the streets, she hadn't been so naive as to believe that she wouldn't steal if she were denied food, though she had assumed that it would take her far longer to reach that state. She didn't head to another corner, but instead shuffled out of the crowds, making her way back into the Idrian slums. Here, she'd gained some small measure of acceptance. At least, she was considered one of them. None knew that she was the princess. After that first man, nobody had recognized her. However, her accent had earned her a place. She began to seek out a location to spend the night. That was one of the reasons she'd decided not to continue begging for the evening. It was a profitable time, true, but she was just too tired. She wanted a good place to sleep. She wouldn't have thought that it would make much difference which alleyway one huddled in, but some were warmer than others, and some had better cover from the rain. Some were safer. She was beginning to learn these things, as well as who to avoid angering. In her case, that last group included pretty much everyone, including the urchins. They were all above her in the pecking order. She'd learned that the second day. She'd tried to bring back a coin from selling her hair, intending to save it for a chance at leaving the city. She wasn't certain how the urchins had known that she had coin, but she'd gotten her first beating that day. Her favorite alleyway turned out to be occupied by a group of men with dark expressions doing something that was obviously illegal. She left quickly, going to her second favorite. It was crowded with a gang of urchins, the ones who had beaten her before. She left that one quickly as well. The third alley was empty. This one was beside a building with a bakery. The ovens hadn't yet been stoked for the night's baking, but they would provide some warmth through the walls in the early morning. She lay down, curling up with her back against the bricks, clutching her shawl close. Despite the lack of pillow or blanket, she was asleep in moments. Chapter 40. Ciri was enjoying a meal on the court green when Trelides found her. She ignored him, content to pick at the dishes in front of her. The sea, she had decided, was quite strange. What else could be said of a place that could spawn creatures with such wiggly tentacles and boneless bodies, and yet others with such needly skins? She poked at something the locals called a cucumber, but which, in actuality, tasted nothing like one. She tried each dish, testing them with her eyes closed, focusing on the flavor. Some hadn't been as bad as the others. She hadn't really liked any of them. Seafood just wasn't appetizing to her. I would have trouble becoming a true Halandrin, she decided, sipping her fruit juice. Fortunately, the juice was delicious. The variety and flavor of the numerous Halandrin fruits were almost as remarkable as the oddity of its sea life. Trelides cleared his throat. The God King's high priest wasn't the one accustomed to waiting. Ciri nodded to her serving women, motioning for them to prepare another series of plates. Sesebron had been coaching Ciri on how to eat with etiquette, and she wanted to practice. Coincidentally, his way of eating, taking small bites, never really finishing anything, was a good one for testing out new dishes. She wanted to become familiar with Halandrin, its ways, its people, its tastes. She'd forced her servants to begin talking to her more, and she planned to meet with more of the gods. In the distance, she saw Lightsong wandering by, and she waved to him fondly. He seemed uncharacteristically preoccupied. He waved back, but didn't come over to visit her. Pity, she thought. I would have liked a good excuse to keep Trelides waiting even longer. The high priest cleared his throat again, this time more demandingly. Finally, Ciri stood, gesturing for her servants to stay behind. "Would you mind walking with me for a bit, Your Excellency?" she asked lightly. She passed him, moving languidly in a gorgeous violet dress with a gossamer train that trailed through the grass behind her. He hurried to catch up.
"I need to speak with you about something."
"Yes," she said. "I deduced that by the way you summoned me several times today."
"You didn't come," he said.
"It seems to me that the consort of the God King shouldn't make a habit of responding to demands and hopping to attend upon others whenever she is requested." Trelides frowned. "However," she continued, "I will of course make time for the High Priest himself, should he come to speak to me." He eyed her, standing tall and straight-backed, wearing the God King's colors of the day, blue and copper.
"You should not antagonize me, Your Highness."
Ciri felt a brief flush of anxiety, but caught her hair before it bleached white. "I am not antagonizing you," she said. "I am simply establishing some rules that should have been understood from the beginning." Trelides got a hint of a smile on his face. "What?" Ciri thought with surprise. "Why that reaction?" As they walked, he drew himself up.
"Is that so?" he said, his voice turning condescending. "You know very little of what you presume, Your Highness."
Blast, she thought. How did this conversation get away from me so quickly? "I might say the same to you, Your Excellency." The massive black temple of a palace loomed above them, sheer ebony blocks stacked like the playthings of a gigantic child.
"Oh," he said, glancing at her, "somehow I doubt that."
She had to force back another spear of anxiety. Trelides smiled again. "Wait," she thought. "It's like he can read my emotions, like he can see." Her hair hadn't changed colors, at least not discernibly. She glanced at Trelides, trying to figure out what was wrong. She noticed something interesting. In a circle around Trelides, the grass seemed just a shade more colorful. "Breath," she thought. "Of course he'd have it. He's one of the most powerful men in the kingdom." People with lots of breath were supposed to be able to see very minute changes in color. Could he really be reading her from such faint reactions in her hair? Was that why he had always been so dismissive? Could he see her fear? She gritted her teeth. In her youth, Ciri had ignored the exercises that Vivenna had done to make sure she had complete control over her hair. Ciri was an emotional person, and people had been able to read her regardless of her hair, so she'd figured that there was no point in learning to manipulate the royal locks. She hadn't imagined a court of gods and men with the power of biochroma. Those tutors had been a whole lot more intelligent than Ciri had credited, as were the priests. Now that she thought about it, it was obvious that Trelides and the others would have studied the meanings of all the shades of hair changes. She needed to get the conversation back on course. "Do not forget, Trelides," she said. "You are the one who came to see me. Obviously, I have some power here, if I could force even the High Priest to do as I wish." He glanced at her, eyes cold. Focusing, she kept her hair the deepest black. Black for confidence. She met his eyes, and let not even a slight tinge color her locks. He finally turned away.
"I have heard disturbing rumors."
"Oh?"
"Yes. It appears that you are no longer fulfilling your wifely duties. Are you pregnant?"
No, she said. I had my women's issue just a couple of days ago. You can ask my servants.
Then why have you stopped trying?
What? She asked lightly. Are your spies disappointed to be missing their nightly show? Trelides flushed just slightly. He glanced at her, and she still managed to keep her hair perfectly black, not even a glimmer of white or red. He seemed more uncertain.
You Idrians, the priest spat, living up in your lofty mountains, dirty and uncultured, but still assuming that you're better than us. Don't judge me. Don't judge us. You know nothing.
I know that you've been listening in on the God King's chamber.
Not just listening, Trelides said. The first few nights, there was a spy in the chamber itself.
Ciri couldn't mask this blush. Her hair remained mostly black, but if Trelides really did have enough biochroma to distinguish subtle changes, he would have seen a hint of red.
I am well aware of the poisonous things your monks teach, Trelides said, turning away, the hatred into which you're indoctrinated. Do you really think that we'd let a woman from Idris confront the God King himself, alone, unwatched? We had to make certain you weren't intending to kill him. We're still not convinced.
You speak with remarkable frankness, she noted.
Merely saying some things that I should have established from the beginning.
He stopped in the shadow of the massive palace.
You are not important here. Not compared to our God King. He is everything, and you are nothing. Just like the rest of us.
If Sesebron is so important, Ciri thought, meeting Trelady's eyes, then why are you planning to kill him?
She held his eyes. The woman she'd been a few months ago would have looked away, but when she felt weak, she remembered Sesebron. Trelades was orchestrating the plot to subdue, control, and eventually kill his own God King. And Ciri wanted to know why.
I stopped having sex with the God King on purpose, she said, keeping her hair dark with some effort. I knew it would get your attention.
In truth, she had simply stopped her little performances each night. Trelades's reaction, fortunately, proved that the priests believed her acting. For that she blessed her luck. They might still be unaware that she could communicate with Sesebron. She was extra careful to whisper at night, and had even taken to writing things herself to keep up the charade.
You must produce an heir, Trelades said.
Or what? Why are you so eager, Trelades?
It is none of your concern, he said. Suffice it to say that I have obligations that you cannot comprehend. I am subject to the gods, and I do their will, not yours.
Well, you're going to have to bend on that last part if you want your heir, Ciri said.
Trelades obviously didn't like how the conversation was going. He glanced at her hair, and somehow she kept it from showing even a slight bit of uncertainty. He looked back at her eyes.
You can't kill me, Trelades, she said. Not if you want a royal heir. You can't bully me or force me. Only the God King can do that. And we know how he is.
I don't know what you mean, Trelades said flatly.
Oh, come now, Ciri said. Did you honestly expect me to sleep with a man and not find out he has no tongue? That he's virtually a child? I doubt he can even go to the privy without help from some servants.
Trelades flushed with anger.
He really does care, Ciri noted abstractedly. Or at least, insulting his God King insults him. He's more devoted than I would have expected.
So it probably wasn't about money. She couldn't be sure, but she suspected that this wasn't the type of man to sell out his religion. Whatever the reasons for what was happening inside the palace, it probably had to do with true conviction. Revealing what she knew about Sesebron
was a gamble. She figured that Trelides would guess anyway, and so it would be better to indicate that she thought Sosebron a fool with the mind of a child. Give away one bit of information, but also mislead with another. If they assumed that she thought Sosebron a fool, they wouldn't suspect a conspiracy between her and her husband. Ciri wasn't certain if she was doing the right thing, but she needed to learn, or Sosebron would die. And the only way to learn was to do. She didn't have much, but she did have one thing that the priests wanted. Her womb. It seemed that she could hold it for ransom effectively, for Trelides suppressed his anger and maintained a semblance of calm. Turning from her, he glanced up at the palace.
"Do you know much about the history of this kingdom? After your family departed, of course."
Ciri frowned, surprised at the question.
"More than you probably think," she thought.
"Not really," she said out loud.
"Lord Peacegiver left us with a challenge,"
Trelides said.
"He gave us the treasure our god-king now holds, a wealth of biochromatic breath such as nobody had ever seen, over 50,000 breaths. He told us to keep them safe."
Trelides turned back to her,
"and he warned us not to use it."
Ciri felt a slight shiver.
"I do not expect you to understand what we have done,"
Trelady said,
"but it was necessary."
"Necessary to keep a man in bondage?" Ciri said. "To deprive him of the ability to speak? To make a permanent child out of a grown man? He didn't even understand what he was supposed to do with a woman."
"It was necessary,"
Trelady said, jaw set.
"You Idrians, you don't even try to understand. I've had dealings with your father for years, and I sense the same ignorant prejudice in him."
"He's baiting me," Ciri thought, keeping her emotions in check. It was harder than she'd expected. "Believing in Ostra instead of your living gods isn't ignorance. After all, you're the ones who abandoned our faith and took an easier path."
"We follow the god who came to protect us when your Ostra, an unseen, unknown thing, abandoned us to the destroyer Kalad. Peacegiver returned to life with a specific purpose, to stop the conflict between men, to bring peace again to Halandrin."
He glanced at her.
"His name is Holy. He is the one who gave us life, Vessel. And he only asked one thing of us, to care for his power. He died to give it to us, but demanded that it be held in case he should return again and need it. We couldn't let it be used. We couldn't let it be profaned. Not even by our god-king."
He fell silent.
"So how do you get that treasure away from him to pass on?" she thought.
She was tempted to ask, would that be giving away too much? Finally, Trelades continued.
"I see now why your father sent you instead of the other one. We should have studied all of the daughters, not just the first. You are far more capable than we had been led to believe."
His statement surprised her, but she kept her hair in check. Trelades sighed, looking away.
"What are your demands? What will it take to make you return to your duties each night?"
"My servants," she said. "I want to replace my main serving women with the women from Pankal."
"You are displeased with your serving women?"
"Not particularly," Ciri said. "I simply feel that I have more in common with the women of Pankal. They, like me, are living in exile from their own people. Besides, I like the browns they wear."
"Of course,"
Trelady said, obviously thinking her Idrian prejudices were behind the request. "The Halandrin girls can continue to serve in the roles that the Pankal women did," Ciri said. "They don't have to leave me completely. In fact, I still want to talk to some of them. However, the main women who are with me always, they are to be from Pankal.
As I said, Trelady said, it shall be done. You'll return to your efforts, then?
For now, Ciri said. That will earn you a few more weeks. Trelades frowned, but what could he really do? Ciri smiled at him, then turned and walked away. However, she found herself dissatisfied with the way the conversation had gone. She'd achieved a victory, but at the cost of antagonizing Trelades even further.
I doubt he would have taken a liking to me, no matter how hard I tried, she decided, sitting down in her pavilion. This is probably the better way.
She still didn't know what was going to happen to Sisebron. At least she had confirmed that manipulating the priests was possible. That meant something, though she knew she was treading dangerous ground. She turned back to her meal, ready to try another round of seafood. She did her best to learn about Halandrin, but if it came down to Sisebron's life, she was going to get him out. She hoped that giving Bluefingers' Pon Call a more prominent role in her service would facilitate that escape. She hoped. With a sigh, she raised the first bit of food to her lips and continued with her tasting.
Chapter 41. Vivenna presented her coin.
One bit? Cads asked. That's all. One single bit.
He was among the dirtiest men she'd met, even in the streets. He liked fancy clothing, though. It was his style. Worn and dirty clothing in the latest designs. He seemed to think it was funny. A mockery of the highborn. He turned her coin over in his grime-covered fingers.
One bit, he repeated.
Please,
Vivenna whispered. They stood at the mouth of an alley at the back of two restaurants. Just inside the alley, she could see urchins rooting in the garbage, fresh garbage from two restaurants. She salivated.
I find it hard to believe, Lady Gurley, he said, that this is all you made today.
Please, Cads, she said again. You know I don't beg well.
It was starting to rain. Again.
You should do better, he said. Even the children can bring me at least two.
Behind him, the fortunates who had pleased him continued to feast. It smelled so good. Or maybe that was the restaurant's.
I haven't eaten in days,
she whispered, blinking away the rain.
Then do better tomorrow,
he said, shooing her away.
My coin.
Cads immediately waved for his tufts as she reached toward him. Vivenna shied away reflexively, stumbling.
Two tomorrow, Cads said, walking into his alleyway. I have to pay the restaurant owners, you know. Can't let you eat for free.
Vivenna stood, staring at him. Not because she thought she could get him to change his mind, but because she just had trouble making her mind understand. It was her last chance for food this day. One bit wouldn't buy anything more than a mouthful elsewhere. But here, last time, it had allowed her to eat until she was full. That had been a week ago. How long had she been on the streets now? She didn't know. She turned, dully, and pulled her shawl tight. It was dusk. She should go beg some more. She couldn't. Not after losing that bit. She felt shaken, as if her most valuable possession had been stolen. No.
No.
She still had that. She pulled the shawl close.
Why was it important?
She had trouble remembering. She shuffled back toward the highlands. Her home. A part of her realized that she shouldn't feel so distant from the person she had been. She was a princess, wasn't she? But she felt so sick lately. Sick enough that she didn't even think she could feel the hunger anymore. It was all so wrong. So very, very wrong. She entered the slums and crept along, careful to keep her head bowed, her back cowed, lest someone take offense at her. She hesitated as she walked, however, passing a street to her right. It was where the whores waited, protected from the drizzle by an awning. Vivenna stared at them, standing in their revealing clothing. It was only two streets into the slum, a place that wasn't too threatening for outsiders. Everyone knew not to rob a man on his way to visit the whores. The slumlords didn't like it when their customers got scared away. Bad for business, as Denth might say. Vivenna stood for a long moment. The whores looked fed. They weren't dirty. Several of them laughed. She could join them. An urchin had spoken of it the other day, mentioned that she was still young. He'd wanted her to come to the slumlord with him, hoping to get some coin for recruiting a willing girl. It was so tempting. Food, warmth, a dry bed. Blessed Ostra, she thought, shaking herself. What am I thinking? What is wrong with my mind? It was so hard to focus, as if she were in a trance all the time. She forced herself to keep moving, stumbling away from the women. She wouldn't do that. Not yet. Not yet. Oh, Lord of Colors, she thought with horror. I need to get out of this city. Better for me to die, starving on the road back to Idris. Better to get taken by Denth and tortured than to end up in the brothel. However, much like the morality of stealing, the morality of using her body seemed much vaguer to her now, when her hunger was such a constant need. She made her way to her latest alleyway. She'd been kicked out of the others, but this one was good. It was secluded, yet often filled with younger urchins. Their company made her feel better, though she knew they searched her at night for coins. I can't believe how tired I am, she thought, head spinning, putting her hand against the wall. She took a few deep breaths. The dizzy spells struck often these days. She started forward again. The alleyway was empty, everyone else staying out in the evening to try for a few extra coins. She took the best of the spots, an earthen mound which had managed to grow a small tuft of grass. There weren't even that many lumps in the dirt, though it would be wet with mud from the light rain. She didn't care about that. Shadows darkened the alleyway behind her. Her reaction was immediate. She started to run. Living on the streets taught quick lessons. Weak as she was in her panic, she managed a burst of speed. Then another shadow stepped across the other end of the alley ahead of her. She froze, then turned to see a group of thugs moving up the alleyway behind her. At their back was the man who had robbed her a few weeks ago, the one who had taken her dress. He looked chagrined.
Sorry, princess, he said. Bounty just got too high. Took me blasted long enough to find you, though. You did a great job of hiding.
Vivenna blinked, and then she simply let herself slide down to the ground. I just can't take it anymore, she thought, wrapping her arms around herself. She was exhausted, mentally, emotionally, completely. In a way, She was glad it was over. She didn't know what the men would do to her, but she did know it was over. Whomever they sold her to wouldn't be careless enough to let her escape again. The thugs clustered around her. She heard one mention taking her to Denth. Rough hands grabbed her arm, towing her to her feet. She followed with her head bowed. They led her out onto the main street. It was growing dim, but no urchins or beggars made their way toward the alley.
I should have realized, she thought. It was too deserted.
Everything, finally, overwhelmed her. She couldn't summon the energy to care about escaping. Not again. A part of her, deep inside, realized that her tutors had been right. When you were weak and hungry, it was hard to summon the energy to care about anything, even escape. She had trouble remembering her tutors now. She had trouble even remembering what it was like not to be hungry. The thugs stopped walking. Vivenna looked up, blinking away her dizziness. There was something in the dark, wet street in front of them. A black sword. The weapon, silver sheath and all, had been rammed into the dirt. The street grew still. One of the thugs stepped forward, pulling the sword from the ground. He undid the sheath clasp. Vivenna felt a sudden nausea, more of a memory than a real sensation. She stumbled back, horrified. The other thugs, transfixed, gathered up around their friend. One of them reached for the hilt. The man carrying the sword struck. He swung the weapon, sheath and all, into the face of his friend. A black smoke began to twist off the sword, rising from the tiny sliver of blade that was visible. Men cried out, each one scrambling for the sword. The man holding it continued to swing, the weapon hitting with far more force and damage than it should have. Bones broke. Blood began to run on the cobblestones. The man continued to attack, moving with terrible speed. Vivenna, still stumbling backward, could see his eyes. They were terrified. He killed his last friend, the one who had robbed her on that day that now seemed so long ago, by slamming the sheathed sword down against the man's back. Bones cracked. By now, the clothing on the sword-wielder's arm was disintegrated, and a blackness, like vines growing on a wall, had twisted up around his shoulder. Black, pulsing veins that bulged out of the skin. The man screamed a piercing, desperate cry. Then he twisted the sword around and rammed it, sheath and all, through his chest. It cut skin and flesh, though the sheath itself didn't look sharpened. The man stumbled to his knees, then slumped backward, twitching, staring up into the air as the black veins on his arm began to evaporate. He died like that, kneeling, held upright by the sword that came out through his back, propping him up from behind. Vivenna stood alone on a street, littered with corpses. A figure descended from a rooftop, lowered by two twisting lengths of animated rope. He landed softly, ropes falling dead. He passed Vivenna, ignoring her, and grabbed the sword. He paused for a moment, then did up the clasp and pulled the weapon, sheath and all, free from the corpse. The dead man finally fell to the ground. Vivenna stared dully ahead. Then, numb, she sat down in the street. She didn't even flinch as Vasher picked her up and slung her over his shoulder. Chapter 42.
Her Grace is not interested in seeing you, the priestess said, maintaining a reverent posture.
Well, I'm not interested in her uninterest, Lightsong said.
Perhaps you should ask her again, just to be sure.
The priestess bowed her head.
My pardons, Your Grace, but I have already asked 14 times. Goddess All-Mother is growing impatient with your requests, and she instructed me not to respond to them anymore.
Did she give the same command to the other priestesses?
The priestess paused. Well, no, Your Grace.
Wonderful, Lightsong said. Send for one of them. Then ask her to ask All-Mother if she will see me.
The priestess sighed audibly.
Lightsong considered that something of a victory. All-Mother's priests were among the most pious and most humble in the court. If he could annoy them, he could annoy anyone.
He waited, hands on hips, as the priestess went to do his bidding. All-Mother could give them orders and commands, but she couldn't tell them to completely ignore Lightsong. After all, he was a god, too. As long as he asked them to do something other than what All-Mother had explicitly forbidden, they had to obey, even if it annoyed their goddess.
I'm developing a new skill, Lightsong said. Irritation by proxy.
Larimar sighed. What about your speech to Goddess Blushweaver a few days ago, Your Grace? It seemed to imply that you were not going to annoy people as much.
I said nothing of the sort, Lightsong said. I simply said that I was coming to recognize within myself a little more of the person I used to be. That doesn't mean I'm going to discard all the progress I've made over the last years.
Your sense of self-awareness is remarkable, Your Grace.
I know. Now hush, the priestess is coming back.
Indeed, the woman approached and bowed before Lightsong on the grass.
My apologies, Your Grace. Our goddess, however, has now requested that no priestess be allowed to ask her if you can come in to see her.
Did she tell them that they couldn't ask if she would come out here?
Yes, Your Grace, the priestess said, and every other phrasing that would imply asking her to come within Your Grace's proximity, or communicate with him by letter, or relay messages from him in any form.
Hmm, he said, tapping his chin. She's getting better. Well, I guess there's nothing to be done.
The priestess relaxed visibly.
Scoot, set up my pavilion here in front of her palace,
Lightsong said.
I'm going to be sleeping here tonight.
The priestess looked up.
You're going to do what?
Larimar asked.
Lightsong shrugged. I'm not moving until I meet with her. That means staying until she acknowledges me. It's been over a week. If she wants to be stubborn, then I'll prove that I can be equally stubborn.
He eyed the priestess.
I'm quite practiced at it, you know. Comes from being an insufferable buffoon and all.
I don't suppose she forbade you from allowing squirrels into the building.
Squirrels, Your Grace?
The woman asked.
Excellent, Lightsong said, sitting down as his servants erected the pavilion.
He pulled the lifeless squirrel from its box and held it forward.
Almond grass,
he said quietly, giving the new command he'd had his people imprint on the lifeless. Then he spoke louder so that the priestess could hear.
Go into the building, search out the returned who lives in it, and run around in circles squeaking as loudly as you can. Don't let anyone catch you. Oh, and destroy as much furniture as you can.
Then more quietly he repeated,
Almond grass.
The squirrel immediately jumped off his hand and shot toward the palace. The priestess twisted her head to follow it, horrified. The squirrel began to screech with a sound that seemed amazingly unsquirrel-like. It disappeared into the building, slipping between the legs of a startled guard.
What a delightful afternoon it's becoming, Lightsong said, reaching for a handful of grapes as the priestess rushed after the squirrel.
It won't be able to follow all of your orders, Your Grace,
Larimar said.
It has the mind of a squirrel, despite the power that breath gives it to obey commands.
Lightsong shrugged. We shall see. He began to hear shouts of annoyance from inside the palace. He smiled. It took longer than he had expected. All-Mother was stubborn, as proved by Blushweaver's complete inability to manipulate her. As he sat, idly listening to a group of musicians, a priestess occasionally checked on him. Several hours passed. He didn't eat or drink very much, so he didn't need to visit the privy. He ordered his musicians to play louder. He had picked a group with a lot of percussion. Finally, a frazzled-looking priestess came out of the palace.
"Her Grace will see you," the woman said, bowing before Lightsong.
"Hm?" Lightsong said. "Oh, that. Do I have to go now? Can't I finish listening to this song?" The priestess glanced up.
Oh, very well, then,"
Lightsong said, rising. All-Mother was still in her audience chamber. Lightsong hesitated in the doorway, which, like those in every palace, was designed at the godly scale. He frowned to himself. People still waited in a line, and All-Mother sat on a throne at the front of the room. She was stocky for a goddess, and he had always considered her white hair and wrinkled face an oddity within the pantheon. In bodily age, she was the oldest of the gods. It had been a while since he'd come to visit her. In fact, the last time I was here was the night before Calmseer gave up her breath, he realized. That evening, years ago, when we shared what would be her last meal. He'd never come back. What would have been the point? They'd only gotten together in the first place because of Calmseer. On most of those occasions, All-Mother had been quite vocal about what she thought of Lightsong. At least she was honest. That was more than he could say for himself. She didn't acknowledge him as he entered. She continued to sit, a little stooped over, listening to the man presenting his petition. He was middle-aged and stood awkwardly, leaning on a walking staff.
"My children are starving now," he said. "I cannot afford the food. I figured if my leg worked, I could go back to the docks."
He looked down.
"Your faith is commendable," All-Mother said. "Tell me, how did you lose the use of your leg?"
"A fishing accident, Your Grace," the man said. "I came down from the highlands a few years back, when early frosts took my crops. I took a job on one of the storm runners, the ships that go out during the spring tempests, catching fish when others remain in the harbor. The accident crushed a barrel against my leg. Nobody will take me on to work the boats, not with a lame leg."
All-Mother nodded.
"I wouldn't have come to you," he said, "but with my wife sick and my daughter crying with such hunger."
All-Mother reached a hand out, laying it on the man's shoulder.
"I understand your difficulties, but your problems are not as severe as you may think. Go and speak with my high priest. I have a man on the docks who owes me allegiance. You have two good hands. You will be put to work sewing nets."
The man looked up, hope glimmering in his eyes.
"We will send you back with enough food to care for your family until you learn your new trade,"
All-Mother said.
"Go with my blessing."
The man rose, then fell back to his knees and began to cry.
"Thank you,"
he whispered.
"Thank you."
Priests walked forward and led the man away. The room fell still, and All-Mother looked over, meeting Lightsong's eyes. She nodded to the side, where a priest stepped up, holding a small bundle of fur tied tightly with ropes.
"That is yours, I am told,"
All-Mother asked.
"Ah, yes,"
Lightsong said, flushing slightly.
"Terribly sorry. It kind of got away from me."
with an accidental command to find me? All-Mother asked, then run around in circles screaming.
That actually worked? Lightsong said. Interesting. My high priest didn't think the squirrel's brain would be capable of following such complicated commands.
All-Mother regarded him with a stern look.
Oh, Lightsong said. I mean, whoops. It completely misunderstood me, stupid squirrel. My deepest apologies, honored sister.
All-Mother sighed, then waved toward a doorway on the side of the room. Lightsong walked that way, and she followed, a few servants trailing. All-Mother moved with the stiffness of age.
Is it me, or does she look older than she did before?
That was, of course, impossible. Returned didn't age, at least not the ones who had reached maturity.
Once they were out of earshot and view of the petitioners, All-Mother grabbed his arm.
What in the name of the colors do you think you are doing?
She snapped. Lightsong turned, raising an eyebrow.
Well, you wouldn't see me, and...
Do you intend to destroy what little authority we have left, you idiot?
All-Mother asked.
Already, people in the city are saying that the returned are growing weak, that the best of us died years ago.
Maybe they're right.
All-Mother scowled.
If too many of them believe that, then we lose our access to breaths. Have you considered that? Have you considered what your lack of decorum, your flippancy, could cost all of us?
Is that the reason for the show, then? He asked, glancing back through the doorway.
Once, the returned didn't just listen to petitions and say yes or no.
All-Mother said.
They would take the time to hear each person who came to them, then seek to help them as best they could.
Seems like an awful lot of trouble.
We're their gods. Should a bit of trouble deter us?
She eyed him.
Oh, of course. We wouldn't want to let something as simple as the pains of our people interfere with our leisure time. Why am I even talking to you?
She turned to leave the room.
I came to give you my lifeless commands,
Lightsong said. All-Mother froze.
Blushweaver has control of 2 sets of the commands, Lightsong said, which gives her control of 1/2 of our armies. That worries me. I mean, I trust her as much as I trust any other returned. But if war does come, then she'll quickly become the 2nd most powerful person in the kingdom. Only the God King would have more authority.
All-Mother regarded him with an unreadable expression.
I figure that the best way to counter her is to have someone else who has 2 sets of commands.
Lightsong said,
perhaps it will give her pause, keep her from doing anything rash.
There was silence in the room.
Calm Seer trusted you,
All-Mother finally said.
Her 1 flaw, I must profess,
Lightsong said.
Even goddesses have them, or so it seems.
I've found it gentlemanly to never point out such things.
She was the best of us,
All-Mother said, glancing out in the direction of her supplicants.
She would meet with people all day. They loved her.
Bottom line blue, Lightsong said. That's my core security phrase. Please, take it. I'll tell Blushweaver that you bullied me into giving it to you. She'll be angry at me, of course, but it won't be the first time.
No, All-Mother finally said.
No. I'm not letting you out of this so easily, Lightsong.
What?
He asked, startled.
Can't you feel it? She asked. Something is happening in the city. This mess with the Idrians and their slums. The increasingly fierce arguments among our priests.
She shook her head.
I'm not letting you wiggle out of your part. You were chosen for that place of yours. You're a god, like the rest of us. Even if you do your best to pretend otherwise.
You already have my command, All-Mother, he said with a shrug,
walking toward a doorway to leave. Do what you will with it.
Verdant bells.
All Mother said.